the studios of KPFK Pacifica Radio in Los Angeles, this is Uprising and I'm Sonali Kohatkar. It's Monday, June 1st, 2015. Hussam Ailush of the Council on American Islamic Relations will join us to discuss the weekend's so-called Muhammad Drawing Contest in Phoenix, Arizona. And Medea Benjamin and Doug Henwood will analyze electoral politics and activism, what the candidacies of Hillary Clinton and Bernie Sanders mean, and how the left can combat election-related mania. That's coming up after the news. Joining us now to analyze today's headlines is Rahul Mahajan. He's a sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. Hi, Rahul. Privacy advocates are celebrating a small victory after three key provisions of the USA Patriot Act expired yesterday because Congress was unable to renew them. Republican Senator Rand Paul successfully blocked the renewal of Section 215 in particular, which provides a legal justification for the National Security Agency to sweep up telephone and other mass communications. But the victory is only temporary, as Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell promised to push a House-passed bill called the USA Freedom Act either tomorrow or Wednesday. Activist groups like Fight for the Future signed on to a statement saying, quote, the USA Freedom Act is a mass surveillance bill dressed up as a reform bill, and its passage will authorize unconstitutional surveillance practices. The political drama played out on Capitol Hill 2 years after whistleblower Edward Snowden alerted the public to the once secret program of surveillance. The Justice Department will likely help craft a legal justification for the temporary lapse in legal authority to spy. Well, Rahul, it appears as though the victory for privacy rights is only symbolic. Should we be surprised that a Republican libertarian has turned out to be the defender of people's rights?
Not really. I mean, I think that, the dominant sort of divide, political divide in the United States in the past few years has been over, does government ever do anything good for you, or should government be opposed on principle? And even though it's been talked about in terms of should government have put any curbs on the rich, and should government do anything to help the poor, since it's been the Republican agenda to oppose those things, when Democrats and when most of the liberal left sort of support the role of government in these things, they have also, in a way, undercut their ability to think critically about things like the NSA's mass surveillance. And of course, that it wasn't helped by the fact that really before Snowden, there was virtually no talk about it that got out into the public sphere. So it's not surprising that it was Rand Paul who sort of carried the banner of resistance in Congress. And it is actually heartening that these minor changes have been made, and if the USA Freedom Act is passed, there will be at least some minimal limits compared to what the NSA does today. The details will actually be to be worked out.
And then Oman is hosting talks between Yemen's Houthi rebels and U.S. officials in a bid toward ending the U.S.-backed Saudi Arabian war against the Persian Gulf's poorest country. Of the six-member Gulf Cooperation Council, Oman is the only nation that did not join the war coalition against Yemen. While the U.S. and Saudi Arabia want Houthi Shia rebels to accept President Hadi, who was driven out, the Houthis want a ceasefire before any formal peace talks. Fears of Iranian influence drive these moves. Even as the Oman talks commenced, airstrikes continue to bombard Yemen today. About 2,000 people have been killed since the bombing first began some months ago, and the 25 million residents of Yemen remain in danger of being cut off from emergency supplies. The Washington Post recently reported an added complication that at least four Americans have been taken hostage by the Houthis. Rahul, do these talks offer a glimmer of hope toward ending the Yemen war?
Well, Sonali, you and I are both old enough to remember back when wars ended, but it seems like since 9/11, we've been in a new paradigm where it's quite possible to start wars, or in some cases to not start wars. But once they're started, they don't seem to end. I mean, the wars the United States directly started have not ended. The wars started by the Arab uprisings in 2011. The only one that you might claim has kind of ended was the uprising in Bahrain, which was, on one side it was unarmed and peaceful, and on the other side there was a massive Saudi invasion that crushed it. But Bahrain is a very small country with a small population, and Yemen is large and has a lot of hostile terrain. So I don't see either the Houthis or Al-Qaeda in Yemen or the Saudi invasion anytime soon, unless there is somehow, once again, we go back 20 years in time.
And finally, the Guardian newspaper in Britain has just concluded a major investigative report on policing in the United States. The report, entitled The Counted, found that of the nearly 500 people killed by U.S. police this year alone, more than a fifth were unarmed. It also found that black people killed by cops were twice as likely to be unarmed than whites. Latinos were a third more likely to be unarmed. African Americans, who comprised 13% of the nation's population, were 30% of this year's police victims. Overall, people of color are half of those killed by cops. 95% of those killed were men, members of the Los Angeles Police Department, killed 10 people this year, the highest number of any department nationwide, and California had 74 deaths, the highest number of police killings of any state. The Guardian intends to continue to update its interactive database of U.S. police killings as the numbers rack up. Rahul, how important is such research, particularly as it enables the public to easily dig into these numbers themselves?
It's extremely important, and it's a great step by the Guardian, and it's really a shame that there is no comprehensive collection of these statistics mandated by the government. But we need a lot more detail than is going to be easy to dig up by, say, the Guardian or by reporters themselves. We need to know much more about the character of the specific incidents. We need more of a sense of the denominator of how many similar kinds of incidents happen without violence happening before we can truly start using this data to get a real picture of how police deal with people.
Rahul, thanks as always for joining us. We'll talk to you next week.
See you then.
Rahul Mahajan is a sociologist and author of Full Spectrum Dominance, U.S. Power in Iraq and Beyond. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. A provocative event in Phoenix, Arizona this weekend ended without violence. A group of Islamophobic activists organized a so-called Muhammad Drawing Contest, the second such event in response to a fatal shooting at a similar event in Garland, Texas on May 3rd. Two men who reportedly worshipped at the Islamic Community Center in Phoenix had driven to Texas and opened fire at the Garland contest in early May, killing a security guard before being shot down by police. This weekend's event in Phoenix was held outside the Islamic Community Center and organized by a U.S. Marine named John Ritzheimer, who in an interview with CNN said he wanted to, quote, expose the true colors of Islam. Ritzheimer has made a name for himself for his practice of wearing a T-shirt that reads F Islam while carrying an American flag. The event drew a number of bikers, many of whom appeared openly armed. A large number of counter-protesters and interfaith groups also gathered to support the Islamic Community Center. On Twitter, a heated debate emerged with people both defending the rights of Muslims and attacking them under the hashtag NotMyAmerica. My guest is Hussam Ailush, Executive Director of CARE LA. Welcome to Uprising, Hussam.
Thank you. I don't know if you can hear me.
Yes, we can. Thanks for joining us. Well, so what sort of link was there first between the two shooters who went to Garland, Texas on May 3rd and ended up attacking the Pamela Geller organized event in Texas and were linked back to this Islamic Community Center that became the target of this weekend's protest? Were they worshippers at that mosque?
From what I heard, it's that they did worship at that mosque. But keeping in mind the mosques, unlike churches, it's a very loose membership. There's actually no membership. Anyone can go, anyone who lives in the area can go to pray at the mosque. So there's no real affiliation. They could actually pray at any other mosques too. So what we've heard that they did frequent that mosque.
Now, how serious a potential for violence was there at the event? And are you surprised that in the end nobody got hurt?
We were very fortunate that no one got hurt at the rally. I mean, this was announced I think it was inspired by the attention that Pamela Geller got in Garland near Dallas, Texas. So this former Marine decided to call upon his buddies and his friends to go and protest the mosque. It's the same mosque that actually has a long history of condemning terrorism. Its imam, its khatib, its speaker has been on record way longer before the incident in Garland, where he condemns terrorism, like most of the mosques and the imams, of course. But unfortunately, this person decided to hold the rally, the anti-Muslim rally, outside the mosque, because of the affiliation of the two shooters with that mosque. Unfortunately, the people who showed up, based on the pictures we saw, did not seem peaceful. They certainly didn't look like Girl Scouts. Many of them showed up armed with weapons and with very horrific signs, intimidating, terrorizing the congregation, including a lot of the children who frequent that mosque. And we're very fortunate, actually, no violence happened, because there was actually a counter rally that happened from the local interfaith community, who showed up in equal number, actually a larger number than the anti-Muslim rally.
And I want to talk about the counter-demonstrators, but the gathering itself was dubbed a freedom of speech rally. Some people posted online ahead of the event saying that they would defend their First Amendment rights by exercising their Second Amendment rights if they had to. Why is this being cast as free speech?
Well, I mean, in reality, in our country, I mean, maybe fortunately so, our constitution permits free speech even from bigots and idiots. And in this case, it's well exercised by that group. But it's obviously a misuse and exploitation of free speech. It's purely intimidation. It's an attempt to terrorize people there. The reason they used free speech is because they did a follow-up to what Pamela Geller did, which is the draw the Muhammad cartoon, the drawing of the Prophet of Islam, Prophet Muhammad, in a way that is intended to offend Muslims. And that is, at the end of the day, free speech, which we acknowledge and respect everybody's right to engage even in offensive and bigoted type of free speech.
And, if the tables were turned and Muslim Americans showed up to a Christian church armed, saying that they were defending their free speech rights and their Second Amendment rights and denigrating Christianity, what sort of response do you think that would evoke?
You can only imagine how many media outlets. You can imagine probably Fox News camping out outside that rally, and then maybe for days and days in and days out would be hearing about how threatful and dangerous the American Muslim community might be and Islam. As you can imagine, there's no need to be hypothetical. This has happened. You know, when there's one incident, one isolated incident, for days and maybe sometimes months and years, we continue to hear the defamation of Islam. And here is a case where, unfortunately, armed, angry, potentially violent people outside of a mosque, getting very little attention from mainstream media, except activist media like yourself, KPFK, and a few other news outlets.
So let's talk about the fact that there were counter-protesters that showed up on the opposite side of the street, some in larger numbers, many from the who do sort of interfaith activist work, even some members of the Christian community. And how important was that showing?
This was actually very inspiring at a local level, but also this event was being watched internationally, not just nationwide. I had calls from BBC, I had people, friends and families calling from various parts of the world, concerned. Because, again, these negative images and negative incidents unfortunately portray an exaggerated image of what is happening. And the reality is, yes, there is a growing Islamophobia, growing in viciousness and hatefulness. But the reality is most people continue to be tolerant, accepting, peaceful, people calling for harmony. And it was important to have that message and image because it really portrayed the reality of what's happening on the ground. This group of people who rallied outside the mosque, the anti-Muslim rally, are the anomaly, the exception to what is happening in America. And this actually was an important message. The Muslim community in Phoenix, but nationwide, truly cannot find words to express gratitude to those who took the time on that Friday to be there, despite the risks they knew they were taking to send a very positive message of unity, unity against hatefulness, against bigotry that was depicted by the anti-Muslim, supposedly, peaceful rally of men holding weapons.
And just to focus a bit on the men holding weapons, and even those that weren't necessarily armed with weapons but were armed with signs and with T-shirts, I mean, they showed themselves in a very negative light. I can't imagine that they would see media coverage of themselves as anything even remotely positive. It just showed such an ugly side. I saw one photo of the event in particular that stood out at me, an older white man with some sort of military-type badge, just yelling with his mouth wide open and grabbing his crotch in defiance and, you know, essentially standing there, you know, screaming at the other side. I mean, in what world do these people think that they appear in a positive light?
You know, the thing is, one thing we've learned over the years is bigoted people are not necessarily the smartest people. Unfortunately, I think they think this is intimidating and this is a positive image. You know, the signs they had, very, very explicit anti-Muslim signs, you know, in language that are very vulgar. There were people wearing signs, wearing T-shirts with the white supremacist, neo-Nazi symbols, you know, the SS.
Yeah.
And you know, for me, I wonder, I can't say everyone who was at the rally, at the anti-Muslim rally, is necessarily a neo-Nazi. But, you know, certainly if I show up to a rally and I notice a lot of neo-Nazis around me, you know, publicly stating their views, I think if I had any common sense, I would exclude myself and, you know, and leave from that rally. But apparently people didn't bother. They stayed there basically feeling comfortable with the crowd. So whether they are neo-Nazis or people who accept being part of a neo-Nazi influenced rally, it brings concern, obviously. And this is not new, by the way. You know, just here in Southern California, many might remember that in 2009, we had a group of neo-Nazis in Riverside who were gathering against a synagogue, a temple here, a Jewish temple. And again, the community came together, united against such racism and sent a very important message of unity and harmony in our area.
Let's talk finally about John Ritzheimer a little bit more. He's the Marine who organized a protest. He basically wears these T-shirts saying F Islam, but of course he spells out the F word, and carries an American flag. He said in an interview about why he organized the protest, he says, "You catch these bank robbers, the driver of the car is guilty by association, and that's how I'm looking at Islam. They are driving the car, and we need to hold them accountable the same way we'd hold the driver of a getaway car. That's how I'm looking at this. They're not holding their own accountable." I think he's referring to the fact that there are groups like ISIS claiming to be Muslim. And how do you respond to that?
I mean, the best example is to, of course, sometimes rationalizing with people like that is a waste of time. Some people are so into the hatred and the ignorance they're in, you can only pray for them. You can only wish that they would see the light one day. But I would say to the rest of the people who might hear from him, it's just a quick reminder. One, we do not practice guilt by association. The American Muslim community, the Muslim community worldwide, has continuously spoken against ISIS and its crimes.
Yeah.
Because the American Muslim community knows that this is a defamation of Islam. The number one victims of ISIS had been Muslims themselves.
Yeah.
85-90% of the victims of the terrorists of ISIS had been Muslims. But even if that was not the case, this is a deviation of the teaching of Islam, and we do not practice guilt by association. And a good example would be, anytime a person who happens to be Christian committing a crime, would we blame Christianity? Did we blame Christianity for the crimes of Timothy McVeigh, who attacked the federal building in Oklahoma City? Did we go to the church? Would we hold the members of his church responsible? Of course not. That'll be nonsense, but unfortunately there are still people who think this is acceptable when it comes to dealing with Muslims and Islam.
And interestingly now, John Ritzheimer says he thinks his life is in danger. He's thinking of starting a crowdfunding campaign to buy security cameras and get self-defense training. A man determined to be a provocateur, worried about provoking people. Hussam, thanks as always for joining us today.
Thank you. Thank you, Sonali.
My guest is Hussam Ailush, Executive Director of CARE LA, the Council on American Islamic Relations. This is Uprising. We'll be right back. Welcome back to Uprising. I'm Sonali Kolhatkar. Hillary Clinton is working hard to attract progressive voters. She announced her campaign on the promise of reducing income inequality after a major speech denouncing the system of mass incarceration that has imprisoned millions of Americans and disproportionately African Americans. She has also announced her full support for immigration reform, going even beyond what Obama has embraced. Clinton went on the record saying she supported a path to full and equal citizenship. On the foreign policy front, Clinton is paying far more lip service to the right, having aligned herself with Henry Kissinger, a man whom many progressives consider the most notorious U.S. war criminal. Possibly complicating the field for Clinton is Bernie Sanders, whose recent announcement included that he too would run for president. At the very least, some hope that he will present a progressive foil to Clinton on domestic economic issues. On international issues, that's another matter, as Sanders notably falls toward the right, specifically on U.S. allegiance to Israel. And then there's a relentless push by some activists to recruit Senator Elizabeth Warren to run for the election. Joining us today to discuss these issues are Doug Henwood, political economist, author of After the New Economy, editor of Left Business Observer, host of a Pacifica Weekly program called Behind the News, and Medea Benjamin, longtime peace activist, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink and the human rights organization Global Exchange, and author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Welcome to Uprising, Doug and Medea.
Thank you.
Well, Doug, let me start with you. Is it fair to say that Clinton seems to be, broadly speaking, tacking to the left of Obama on domestic issues and tacking to the right of Obama on foreign policy issues, or is that just too simplistic?
Well, it's really hard to say what Hillary actually said, other than, you know, the status quo. She is doing a rather aggressive imitation of someone who's progressive on domestic issues. She's denouncing income inequality. She spoke recently of toppling the 1%, even as she's trying to raise a lot of money from them. She's talking about ending mass incarceration despite her husband's contribution to it. So she's in some sense running against what she's been working at for the last 20 or 30 years. I don't know if anybody's going to fall for it, but I wouldn't trust it for a moment.
And do you agree with that, Medea? You recently wrote a piece calling Hillary Clinton a hawk.
Well, she certainly is a hawk. She was a hawk when she was a senator. She was a hawk as Secretary of State. And she's a hawk now. Her policies have been disastrous. She supported the invasion of Iraq. She called on Obama to double the number of troops in Afghanistan when he was talking about the surge. She was disastrous in the policy around Libya that led to the overthrow of Gaddafi and the dysfunctional state that exists now. So I would certainly say that while she's trying to position herself as a liberal on a lot of social issues, she is definitely a hawk when it comes to foreign policy. On the other hand, we should admit that she has been supportive of Obama's talks with Iran, which is a positive thing.
Doug Henwood, should we be taking very serious lessons, taking very serious lessons from President Obama's campaign during his campaign for the presidency? And of course, he was a much more blank slate than Clinton is. Clinton has the baggage of many, many years, not only as state senator, secretary of state, but also, of course, first lady. But Obama made so many promises that he never kept. And if people fall for Clinton and her promises, will we be fooled twice?
Well, I would think so. And as you said, Obama was a blank slate in some sense. He was much easier to project fantasies of what he might be, you know, the community organizing history. And he can talk a good game. He's very impressive, as is Hillary. These are very sophisticated, intelligent, crafty people. But Hillary has a very long record. And she, I wrote this cover piece for Harper's last fall. Stop Hillary was the arresting title they gave it. And when I started doing the research of the piece, I thought she was much more of a passenger on the Bill Express than she actually turned out to be. She's been a very much collaborator. It's been very much a partnership of equals from the beginning. They've talked about this strategy of 8 years of Bill and 8 years of Hill for 40 years. So she has a very, very long record. And most of it is on the conservative side of the Democratic spectrum, and she's obviously not Marco Rubio, but she is aggressive on foreign policy, as Medea pointed out. I'm not sure I really believe how supportive she is of the Iran deal, given her allegiance to Israel and to us, for a Democrat, surprisingly, to Netanyahu. She's just she and Bill practically invented the whole regime of teacher testing in Arkansas, the anti-union stances they took in the early days in Arkansas. So they invented this kind of modern new Democrat philosophy, and now that is really old and out of fashion. She's trying to throw it over, but I don't know, her history is a little too long just to believe some religion that she suddenly gets in the heat of a campaign.
Medea Benjamin, you wrote about the meeting that you had and your organization Code Pink had with Hillary Clinton more than a decade ago, where essentially she agreed to talk to you about her support for the Iraq War. Can you describe that meeting for our audience?
Well, I'll never forget that meeting, and it's nice that we do have a video of it, because we went to her office and did a sit-in, and we were about 100 women. It's Code Pink, and we were at that time wearing pink slips. And the idea is that we were going to her office to say either we were going to be supportive of her stand around Iraq, or we were going to give her a pink slip saying we didn't need her services. And because we refused to leave her office, her staff said, okay, we will get her. She was on the floor of the Senate. They put us in a room where all of us could sit down. They brought her from the Senate floor. We told her that we had just come back from Iraq, that the Iraqi people were desperate because they were so afraid of a U.S. invasion. They had no idea what they could do to defend their families. And we said that Iraq had nothing to do with 9/11. We talked to weapons inspectors while we were in Iraq, and they said there were no weapons of mass destruction. And could she come out and say that she would not vote for the war? And she basically sounded like she was George Bush. She said, you know, I am a senator from New York. I have to protect my people from New York, and this is an evil man, and blah, blah, blah. And at the end, my co-founder, Jody Evans, took off her pink slip and basically threw it at Hillary Clinton and said, we don't need your services. Unfortunately, we still have had her services for a long time. But I've heard that there are people who are going to go to her campaign appearances with the list of over 4,000 U.S. Soldiers and who died in Iraq, and start reading off those names, trying to hold her accountable for her vote.
Now, Doug Henwood, one of the things that Clinton has come under strong criticism for, well, there are many things, and I do want us to take the time to go through them, but she and Bill have been involved, including her daughter Chelsea, have been involved in the Clinton Foundation, which has come under fire, most recently for their global initiative being hosted at a meeting in Morocco by a Moroccan mining company called OCP, known for serious human rights violations. And in the past, it's also come to light that companies like ExxonMobil and Monsanto have donated to this foundation, and they might be pulling back their support now, probably realizing that they're going to be a liability for a Clinton presidency, and who knows what sorts of backroom discussions have been happening there. But should we see the ties of the Clinton Foundation as a, you know, is it proper or appropriate fodder for discussion on President Hillary Clinton?
Yeah, you know, before I answer that, I'd like to just add a footnote to what Medea said. When the vote for the Iraq War is coming up, Hillary deliberately did not read the National Intelligence Estimate because it was skeptical about the WMDs in Iraq, the secret one. The one that was released to the public, was some of the skepticism was erased. But she did deliberately did not read that because she so wanted to vote for the war that she didn't want to complicate it with facts. And that's not like her. She's the kind of person who reads documents. So that was a really strange and deliberate decision to vote for a war that she probably knew was being launched on false pretenses, but she had to play along for political reasons. And now we'll go on to the Clinton Foundation. I mean, this is a very interesting family. This family has gotten rich off politics in a way I don't know if there's any precedent for it. It's like the family business. And now they're bringing in the younger generation. And they've used this thing to, this conservative book by Peter Schweitzer has some problems. But you know, I think he's getting to something, that they're selling access to an ex-president, then Secretary of State, and a possible future president. And for rich people and big corporations and big foundations to give a few hundred thousand or even a few million dollars to these people, it's pocket change for those folks. But, you know, it adds up. It's made the Clintons multimillionaires many times over. They've raised, I think, $2 or $3 billion over the last decade or so from these sorts of interests, predominantly financial, media companies, these sorts of very, you know, very big names. You know, she is the senator from Goldman Sachs, or was the senator from Goldman Sachs in many ways. It's really smelly. It's a whole system of selling access and back scratching and ego inflation. And it's really not a way of democracy it should be run. And, they're very devious about what they release. We don't really know who's given what and what has been gotten in return. And it's just a very, very smelly business.
Amidia Benjamin, on the same question, what do you make of the Clinton Foundation and whether we should be considering its method of doing business when assessing Hillary Clinton as a presidential candidate? And also there's a controversy about very sloppy tax returns being filed, which really does make one wonder because, you know, certainly it's important for there to be not only financial transparency when we look at a presidential candidate, financial transparency in their dealings, but in general, how open they are to outside scrutiny and to filing proper tax returns. I mean, this should be a simple thing. These folks can afford to hire good, tax preparers.
Well, I think everything is open, and particularly in terms of the foundation and the many corporations that have given money to the foundation, because this really has implications for her economic policies, her policies around trade deals, and she has not been consistent about that at all, supporting some trade deals, opposing other ones. So I think it all relates to her very pro-business stand and her interest in the foundation put her in very cozy relationship with a lot of companies that many of us are not comfortable with.
And Medea, there's also the controversy of Clinton using her own personal email address, which was housed on a private server while she was Secretary of State. That controversy seems to have waned a little bit. It'll probably come back in the media coverage. That too doesn't bode well for transparency, does it?
No, not at all. And I think that was a tremendous blunder on her part. And I'm surprised that it
is. Do you think it was a blunder or something more insidious?
Well, insidious and a blunder at the same time, because it's a blunder if you think that she's smart enough to know that this would come out and that this would affect her. excuse me, I'm surprised that it's subsided, but it will certainly be an issue during the campaign. And as you said, it is an issue about transparency. And with the sensitivity that many of us have around our government's lack of transparency, and we have the case of Obama being one of the least transparent, I think that it does not bode well for Hillary Clinton that she has such a bad record on this already.
Much more to talk about, including Bernie Sanders' candidacy, but staying on the Clinton candidacy for a little bit, I want to discuss the way it's being viewed in popular media. Saturday Night Live's Cecily Strong headlined at the 2015 White House Correspondents' Dinner in Washington, D.C. on April 25th. And I want to play for our audience and our guests today a little bit of what she had to say about Hillary Clinton.
I'm excited about Hillary running. Though I'm not sure she's excited about having to run. I think she feels the same way Meryl Streep feels when she's asked to audition for something. Are you kidding me? You making it go through this? I mean, you know I'm gonna win. Ugh. All right, guys, now, this next part is a repeat after me, so I need your help here. I want all the media to put their hands up and swear something this election season, okay? I solemnly swear not to talk about Hillary's appearance, because that is not journalism.
Cecily Strong of Saturday Night Live speaking at the White House Correspondents' Dinner April 25th. Well, there's a couple of issues here that I thought are well illustrated. First, the sense of entitlement that Clinton is being made to run a campaign, and we should just all assume she'll win. And the other issue, of course, how the media is going to cover her. Doug, on the first issue, is there a sense of entitlement?
Oh my God, yes. I mean, she's raising $100 million for this primary campaign.
Wow, $100 million.
I wouldn't say exactly uncontested, but you know, the likelihood of her winning is close to certainty. So raising $100 million for that is pretty amazing. And then eventually she's going to probably raise $1 billion or more for the general. But yeah, she's had this sense of entitlement for her entire life. If you go back and read the history of her days in Arkansas again, she got... When she was working at the Rose Law Firm, she was like, they needed a swimming pool. There wasn't one in the governor's mansion. She wanted those, and it just like one thing after another. And this led to one compromise after another with power. You know, whatever progressive instinct she had when she was in college and in law school quickly evaporated when she became the partner with the Rose Law Firm, and she became the loyal servant of corporate Arkansas, doing business before the state when her husband was attorney general and governor. Yes, there's a sense of entitlement and also of intense sense of secrecy and arrogance. The email scandal is entirely consistent with her whole history. She hates the press. She hates publicity. you start talking about the Whitewater billing records and people think you're nuts, but they disappeared for a year and a half or 2 years, and they suddenly reappeared again in a private room in the White House. So Hillary lost those and found them again when the time became convenient. She has this history of evading scrutiny because she thinks she's above it, and she thinks whatever she does is the right thing, and nobody should ask any questions. And that attitude is really not what we need right now. She's very secretive, and she's very much, I think she'd be very much into surveillance. So we've had enough government secrecy and enough government surveillance, and I think she would actually intensify it if that's possible. So it's a bad combination.
Medea Benjamin, on that same issue, not just the sense of entitlement, but also I think what Cecily Strong made, which was a very good point, which is that probably the worst things that progressives are going to have to fight against in criticism of Hillary Clinton is sexist media coverage, right?
Yes, on the one hand, I think we want to agree that her looks should not be an issue in the campaign. Her level of estrogen should not be an issue. I saw the op-ed about how she'd be a good candidate because she's postmenopausal, which disgusting and implying that somebody who is premenopausal would not be a good candidate. All of that should be banished from this talk about the campaign. But on the other hand, we also shouldn't say we want her elected because she's a woman. She is a woman. It would be wonderful to have a woman president, just like it was wonderful to have an African-American president. But we want to vote on people based on their positions on the issues and not based on their gender.
Let's also briefly, and Medea, I want to stay with you and then go to Doug on this issue as well. Hillary Clinton has, and I mentioned this earlier, has made it very clear that on foreign policy, particularly, she stands right there with Henry Kissinger, which is really dramatic. In fact, it was a year ago, and I wrote a column on Truthdig about this, how she wrote a review in a major paper of Kissinger's book and how it was just incredible the way in which she cozied up to a man that the left considers one of the worst war criminals in recent U.S. memory. I mean, doesn't she realize that might cost her some progressive votes?
Unfortunately, I don't think many Americans even remember the legacy of Henry Kissinger when he was testifying in Congress recently and Code Pink went up with our banners saying, arrest the war criminal, waving handcuffs in front of him. We got so many people saying, why are you against this nice 91-year-old man? What a terrible thing to do. So the United States of amnesia, unfortunately, is true in this case, that most people really have no idea about Henry Kissinger, except that he's a nice 91-year-old man. On the other hand, yes, it is horrendous that she would cozy up to Kissinger, and it's horrendous that she would support Kissinger-like policies today, such as supporting the coup in Honduras. We know that Kissinger not only supported the coup in Chile, but was one of the architects. But we can fast forward to the coup in Honduras, where Hillary Clinton, as Secretary of State, was very anxious to legitimize the coup government in Honduras and has done so.
Doug Henwood, on the same issue of cozying up to Henry Kissinger, I'd love to get your thoughts. And also the challenges that you are going to face personally as a male critic of Hillary Clinton. And I think you already have faced people labeling you a sexist for being a critic of, President Hillary Clinton.
Yeah, what can I say? I try... certainly avoid all the sexist caricatures and denounce them whenever I can. They're revolting and distracting and have nothing to do with what's wrong with her. I want people to hate her for the right reasons, not the wrong reasons. You know, the thing with Henry Kissinger is also very consistent with her history. When she got to the Senate, she promptly wanted made a beeline for the Armed Services Committee. She's very comfortable with generals. She is, I think, much more hawkish than Obama. I mean, I think, although, you know, she says she supports the Iran deal, I don't think, had she been Secretary of State, she would have negotiated as energetically as John Kerry did. And had she been president, I don't think she would have pushed for it as energetically as Obama did. I think she is very, very warlike and has been for almost her entire life. You know, she was a Goldwater girl back in the 60s. Although she certainly shed some of that republicanism, that kind of militarism is still deep in her character, and it shouldn't surprise us that she fawns all over Henry.
And then Doug, let's talk about Bernie Sanders before I want Medea's opinion on that as well. So Bernie Sanders had long sort of flirted with the idea of running, finally did announce his candidacy. In fact, in an Iowa straw poll, he polled right behind Hillary Clinton with 15% of the vote. Significant, not significant enough, but significant given that he is openly a socialist. And you as an economist, Doug, I'd love to hear your opinion on his candidacy, but also how the media are viewing him as a foil for Clinton, sort of this convenient prop that Clinton can set herself against.
Yeah, well, it's going to be interesting because there are people who are saying that, you know, Hillary should deserve the nomination eventually, but she has to work for it a little bit because it'll make her a sharper candidate. That's a very strange understanding of what the primary season is supposed to be about, but I think a lot of people looking to it for that. And then she can sort of practice her populism as well in campaigning against Sanders. And he, of course, will, you know, certainly not going to launch an independent challenge. He'll probably support her when she wins the nomination. I'm not so sure how serious his challenge is to her. His policy proposals are rather thin. A friend of mine is actually doing some advising of the Sanders campaign and says there's really not much there. His policy people are very weak. He doesn't have much in the way of ideas. He's got a few emotional slogans that he's been throwing around for a couple of decades, but there's really not much substance to his proposals, and maybe he'll develop those as the campaign goes on. And it's certainly good to have somebody who is, I guess these days, a socialist is actually just a Keynesian. That's what's happened to our political spectrum. I think it's important to hear people, for people to hear Sanders talking about the things he's talking about and will talk about in the campaign. Warren has forced, Elizabeth Warren has also forced Hillary to talk about inequality in totally unbelievable ways, but she is at least forcing her to address the issue. And I think Sanders will also do the same.
So, Medea Benjamin, your opinion on a Sanders candidacy, and I should mention Sanders, who's an independent candidate, has chosen to run for the Democratic nomination rather than as an independent candidate. What do you make of it? And also, given that, one of your main expertise is being foreign policy, how you feel about Sanders, who seems weak on foreign policy, except on Israel, he actually takes a strong stand, but in the wrong direction?
Well, I think it's great he's running. You know, I look at the cast of characters for the Republican Party, and every day we have a new crazy person running for president. I think it's great. I wish that there were a wider cast of characters in the Democratic Party, and I'm glad Bernie Sanders came forward. I wish Elizabeth Warren were run. I wish that Jill Stein, as Green Party candidate, would get the kind of press that she deserves. Bernie coming in is only a good thing. Is he as good on the issues as I would like him to be? No. And you brought up, Sonali, the issues around Israel. He certainly will not stand up and say, let's cut the $3 billion in aid that we give to this repressive regime every year. He blames Hamas for the Israeli invasion of Gaza. While he talks, he's way better than Hillary Clinton on the wars. He hasn't been very forthcoming about opposition to the drone wars. He talks about cutting the Pentagon budget, but he doesn't really come out with a, here's my position of how we should slash the Pentagon budget by X percent. He says, well, we don't want to raise it to the detriment of education and healthcare. So look, it's very good when other people enter the Democratic race from the left, from the right, wherever they're going to do it, just so we have more of a debate. And Bernie Sanders is certainly going to be way better than Hillary Clinton on issues of war and peace. But we need somebody to the left of Bernie Sanders, like a Jill Stein, and to really push her more on these issues and to push the whole debate and the whole country.
Jill Stein, who ran as a Green Party candidate for governor of California. What about Elizabeth Warren,
and
Medea?
For president and for president, and we'll that's be right. For president.
And what about Elizabeth Warren, Medea? Any opinions on that?
Well, you know, I think Elizabeth Warren on the economic issues is just fantastic. And I also find her more inspiring than Bernie Sanders, who tends to be more curmudgeonly just as a person. I think that many women and people in general would be inspired by an Elizabeth Warren candidacy. And she's actually more easily to push on some of these foreign policy issues, perhaps, because she is new to them. And we have seen from some of the extreme lobbying that we call it, which means not just making a phone call or going to talk to an aide, but actually doing sit-ins in her offices, die-ins in her offices. Right after the last Israeli invasion of Gaza, we went in as mourning mothers with rubble that we just dumped all over her office in Washington, D.C., and refused to leave until we could have a substantive talk with her top aides on these issues. And she has moved slightly on this. So I think it would be exciting to have her in the race. Unfortunately, I don't think she's going to do it.
Well, Doug Henwood, let's talk broadly speaking now about what happens to progressives and progressive causes come election time. It seems to be that a lot of movements get derailed because they expend a lot of energy, not just into the sort of basic get out the vote types of activities, but into actually campaigning for presidential candidates who are already getting so much money from corporations that they could simply hire others. But it happens every 4 years that very well-meaning, sincere activists leave their nonprofit work or other organizing work that they might be doing to go and work in campaigns. And a lot of people just get seduced by the idea that if only we had the right person in the White House, if only, if only, if only.
Yeah, I think it's very depressing to see this happen every 4 years. I've been through enough cycles now that I'm very familiar with it. But, you know, it's just the same thing happens again. People do not remember what they said or did 4 years ago and how they're disappointed 4 years ago or 8 years ago or, you know, 16 years ago. It's just the same thing over and over again. We fall for this. If we don't work for this Democrat, then the fascists will take over. You know, this rhetoric has been around. When I was doing some research a while back and came across a 1964 article by Hal Draper, which is like quoting that sort of rhetoric just change the names and you have the same thing today. It's amazing how we just go through this endless repetition of the same. I think presidential politics for people, progressives, people on the left, are mostly a distraction. That it is so much an elite office that the ruling class has such a lock in that office that you can get the St. Francis in there, and it's still going to be a ruling class office. It's part of the job description is performing war crimes. I don't think that getting the right person in there is going to change much of anything. I think it's much more fruitful for people to organize, locally and around specific issues. And the presidency is going to be for the billionaires. And that's just until the broad landscape of American politics changes significantly, that's always going to be true. We have to change it from the bottom up. And I don't think the presidency is the place to start.
Well, Medea Benjamin, what is your opinion on the same issue, the role that or the way in which electoral politics subsumes the left every 4 years? And also then, do you feel that the best role for progressives ought to be to strongly critique every single candidate on the right or the left that we see from the left, critique them from the left?
Well, of course, that should be our job. And I agree with Doug, it's mainly a distraction and we should be critiquing them from the left. But we should really have learned a lesson from Obama. And I see why people were so attracted to Obama. And I don't see the same level of attraction that will probably happen around Hillary Clinton with young people in droves, leaving their jobs, leaving their school, taking semesters off. Yes, some will do that because she's a woman and they want to see a woman elected. But it wasn't the same kind of thing when there was the possibility of the first black president, somebody who wasn't from the ruling dynasty itself, who was a fresh face, at a time when we were so destroyed with 8 years of the Bush regime that people were just so anxious for a change. I'm hoping that we can use this time to be building the mass movements we need to build and to be challenging all of the candidates from the most progressive position possible. I'm hoping that we see this is a time to connect the Black Lives Movement to the militarization of our country in general, to connect the environmental movement to the issues of how we spend our money, our budget priorities, what we need to do to move into a peace economy, a green economy. We saw what happened with Obama and the peace movement, which is that the peace movement died. And because the peace movement died when Obama came into office, we have 12 years of drone warfare, 12 years of perpetual war in the Middle East and beyond. I think it's time for us to really reflect on our role in building grassroots movements that connect to each other, that are not tied to the hip to the Democratic Party or any party for that matter. And that our role is really to build from the bottom up.
Now, and let's actually focus for a minute on the way in which candidates like Hillary Clinton and in general, traditionally Democratic candidates have worked to seduce communities of color to be, there to support them. And they've reliably been able to count on voter support. And Doug Henwood, I want to ask you, Medea brought up the issue of the Black Lives Matter movement and Hillary Clinton's actually quite powerful speech on mass incarceration, where she clearly laid out that there's something deeply wrong with a system that, so disproportionately incarcerates young black men, will that not seduce, rightly so perhaps, African-American voters? Because who else at this point is speaking to these issues? Bernie Sanders hasn't brought them up well enough. Other left candidates may have brought them up and aren't getting attention. And the right, none of the right-wing candidates are certainly bringing it up.
Yeah, I think it's interesting. She gave that speech in the presence of former New York City Mayor David Dinkins. And I think it's an institute at Columbia named after him. And he was the guy who started the police buildup in New York City, even before Giuliani took office. So, you know, we have to look. The Democratic Party's record in this stuff is not so good. And certainly Bill Clinton and his crime bill was just a horror, increasing the number of federal death penalty crimes and encouraging an acceleration in the process of mass incarceration. So she can say anything she wants now, but she does have to confront that record. And forgive me if I'm skeptical that she's actually going to do much of anything about it. I think she's just playing the purely opportunistic game now. She realizes that the environment has changed, that there's not the support for the Get Tough on Crimes, crime position that there once was, with crime rates way down. That just doesn't have the emotional resonance it did in the 80s and 90s. I really find it hard to believe that she would launch any major reversal of this policy of mass incarceration. I think she'd look for modest technical reforms, better training, better monitoring. This is the heritage of the Democrats in the crime thing, which in the long run only serves to legitimate mass incarceration by making the process look fairer and less vicious. I think it's really something that needs to be scrutinized very carefully with a whole lot of skepticism. I don't think she's the right agent for this.
And then, Medea Benjamin, the same question on the issue of Latinos and the Latino vote and the vote of newly naturalized citizens. Hillary Clinton very recently using terms that even President Obama hasn't used, wanting full and equal citizenship, a path to full and equal citizenship. And she very clearly laid out saying, this is where I differ with everybody on the Republican Republican side. Make no mistake, not a single Republican candidate announced or potential is clearly and consistently supporting a path to citizenship. Many communities who have undocumented relatives, many have come out reacting quite positively to this. And of course, it's important to hear this lip service. Advocates for immigration reform, as well as, you know, the Dreamers, et cetera, are obviously thrilled to hear this. But, you know, is this, again, a seduction of a core constituency?
Well, of course it is. I mean, she's a calculating woman, and she knows exactly where she needs to get her votes from. And she's got a huge machine, and this machine is telling her that this is what she needs to say to get the support from this community. And I totally understand why the immigrant rights community would be delighted to hear these words from her. But I think it's also a community that has learned over the course of the Obama years to be have a healthy degree of skepticism and cynicism. And it's also a community that knows that grassroots activism is really what's going to change things. So I assume that this community is going to applaud her for her words, but keep the organizing going.
Well, we just have about a minute left. Doug, I want to get your last thoughts on this issue, and if we have time, Medea, as well, on how you expect the next few months to unfold, not just with where the candidates might go, but the media coverage that you think might, it does just hope the media coverage, I suppose, stays focused on the right issues.
Well, I think it's going to be pure hell, a torrent of lies and cliches, and it'll be excruciating to live through. I wish I could go into hibernation for the next 15 months or so. I'm not so dogmatic that I think that there could be things that would be marginally better to have Hillary as president than to have Ted Cruz as president. There's no question about it. The Republican Party is insane and frightening. But I think we should not have any illusions about what they're like, and certainly not give up on any mass mobilizations. Like Medea pointed to the collapse of the peace movement. That's very important. You can multiply that into many other areas where people should remain alert, skeptical, and keep the pressure on and not give up just because Hillary's in the White House.
Medea, last few seconds, your last thoughts?
I would say the same thing as Doug, that we're going to be bombarded with all of these candidates, and I hope more will step forward for the Democratic Party. But let's remember that no matter who is in the White House, our power will come from how good are we at building up a broad grassroots base that intertwines all of these issues and puts the pressure on whoever is in the White House.
Thank you both so much for joining us today. My guests are Doug Henwood, political economist, author of After the New Economy, and editor of Left Business Observer, host of a Pacifica weekly program called Behind the News, and Medea Benjamin, longtime peace activist, co-founder of the peace group Code Pink, and also Global Exchange, and the author of Drone Warfare, Killing by Remote Control. Thanks so much.
Thank you, Sonali. Nice to be on.
This is Uprising. Anna Buss is our assistant producer, and Christian Beck is our production coordinator. Alexander Hobbs is our technical director. Federico Garcia is our audio engineer. Annie Mendoza is our social media coordinator. Subscribe to our YouTube channel at youtube.com/uprisingwithsonali. Our website is uprisingwithsonali.com. Our theme music is by Quetzal. I'm Sonali Gohatkar, host and executive producer of Uprising. I'll see you next time.